Welcome, everyone. My name is Quita Schwain, and I currently live in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach creative writing and composition at St. Olaf College. My training is very much in the writing of poetry, not so much, I don't have a PhD in a certain, in English, I don't have a PhD in a certain, so I'm not an expert at a certain time in poetry or person or movement, but my expertise lies more in knowing how to take an individual poem and sort of take it apart and look at it and try to put it back together again and see how it means. So my great joy in being here this week has been getting to do that every day with a bunch of really intelligent individuals. So I'm pretty excited about that. The topic this week has been quote-unquote great poems. We've been trying to, the first day we came up together with a definition of what a great poem might, we imagined ourselves on the Norton Anthology board as though we were the ones that were going to determine which poems got into the Norton. And so we came up with some criteria that we thought we would use in determining which poems were great. So our criteria involved these things. That a great poem would speak to you on an initial reading. So at some level, you get something out of the poem on a first reading. Maybe you don't understand the whole thing, but there's something that you like or that intrigues you, that grabs hold of you. But also that the poem would keep speaking. That is, that it's not something where you really only need to read it once to get the full meaning and to wring everything out of it that's possibly there. Great poems keep on meaning. We keep on uncovering layers of meaning the more and more we get to know these poems. We all said that music was important. We all said, well, most said, I can't speak for those that didn't speak up, but many said that what was important was intentionality of the form. The poems we've looked at thus far in the week had very particular forms. Today we're going to be looking at a free verse poem. So the question of how form comes into play with this poem is going to be a little bit different from the last couple days. So we'll see if this poet does have intentionality about what she's doing. We said attention to language was really important. We said attention to image and imagination was really important. And finally, we kind of determined that all of these parts needed to be working together cohesively to create a greater whole. Another way of talking about this, the sort of a possible definition or qualification that I want to offer you up today, that I want to think about as we examine this particular poem, is if the same thing, if the same sentiment, if the same meaning, if the same experience could be said or given to us as clearly and entirely in another form, and by another form I mean an essay or a story or an anecdote or a recipe or whatever, then it's not a poem. That is, I'm just offering up another definition, that part of what makes a great poem is that there's no other way, that the form of a poem is necessary to get this meaning or feeling or experience across. If it could be summed up and given to the reader in a different form, then it's not a great poem. I'm just offering that as a different definition. What do you guys think of that? Any initial reactions to that?
Well, it sounds kind of elitist to me.
Okay. Why?
Because there are many ways to express things.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry is one way. If a poetry can express something, I would say succinctly and coherently,
uh-huh.
If a poem can do that, then the expression is valid. If that
uh-huh.
can be done in an essay or in some other form,
uh-huh.
amen.
Right. What
okay,
I would say
so
is
would,
that
maybe
what
not
you're
a
trying,
great poem.
Let's say you're trying to, let's say, you're trying to express the lost love or something like that, and you choose the poem as a form. My argument would not be that you can't, I'm not saying there's no way to express that feeling of lost love in a different way, but there's that you couldn't give the reader the same complete experience that a poem permits through a different form. That the poem becomes necessary in order to articulate the whole of this experience. Does that make sense or no?
It makes sense in terms of something like that. But I'm personally not convinced that would be the only
okay.
way.
Okay. No. Great.
Right.
Good.
I favor
good.
Poetry for that purpose.
Okay. Okay. Sam?
Yeah.
Seems like a great check for the writer of
mm-hmm.
the poem,
mm-hmm.
essay, or whatever it's going to be.
Okay.
It's less useful for me as a reader because
uh-huh.
in some ways, maybe I'm just not discerning enough. But because I love the idea that you could sense whether someone's being as judicious as they can and as succinct and
uh-huh.
clear. But it seems like a great thing to ask in the process.
As a writer. Okay. Great. Yeah.
Well, I always do better with specifics, so I have to think of a poem and think about whether I could read it a different way. And it wouldn't be as beautiful, Wordsworth,
uh-huh.
about the daffodils.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't be as beautiful because it's just so marvelous with the few words.
Okay.
But you could have wonderfully written essay about how he felt having seen these daffodils
uh-huh.
and how the vision keeps coming back to
uh-huh.
him over and over again. So I could see the same story come.
The same story could come through.
Mm-hmm. The same information.
Would you have the same experience reading it, though?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to know because unless somebody gives you a poem version, an essay version of the same thing, it's kind of a, yeah. Did you
ever hear that? I was going to say, kind of going off of what Sam says, I don't know if I'm agreeing or disagreeing, that I feel like it kind of takes the author out of it. So like, to say that perhaps that's the author can convey it best through a poem,
uh-huh.
but maybe they can convey it better through an essay or something. So to say that it's not a poem unless this is sort of taking the author out of it.
Okay, the author's intention sort of?
The author's ability.
Okay.
You know, perhaps they could say it best as a poem, where perhaps someone else could
say
it best as an essay.
Okay.
It's not necessarily about the message, it's about someone's ability to deliver a certain way.
Okay. No, that's great.
Jim. I was going to say, as a pastor, Katie, I can think of a number of times when I've attempted to put the text into a poem. And after struggling with it for a period of time, I decided it wasn't poem material.
Okay.
So then I go to something else.
All right. So what is it? So in relationship to this, what are you weighing?
Well, I'm just saying that if it can't be said as clearly or as entirely in another form, then it's not a poem. And so when I decided something was to be expressed more clearly and entirely in another form, or at least not in the poetic form I was trying, then I
yep.
went to another form.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the nice things about poetry as opposed to other fiction is that you can say a lot without over-explaining.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, writing a poem, I always have to face the danger of, when it's longer, of over-explaining things.
Yes.
And so sometimes, if you want a lot of power in a little words, the poetry is the way to go, because either way, you can't argue that the length of the poem or the essay is going to affect the pace and the experience of the reader, like, no matter what. So
okay.
it's not like this is better than this, but
just different.
Yeah,
absolutely. And maybe another way to ask this, slightly different, is could the poem be summarized? And the idea that if the poem could be summarized, then it's not a great poem. Oh, that's another way of sort of saying it. Yeah.
So when you were saying this, Edgar Guest came to mind.
Uh-huh.
And of course, to me, Edgar Guest would have best been not expressed as poetry. So maybe there are choices about what or one uses.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's dive into this poem so we can talk a little bit more about what I mean. Or don't mean. Today we're looking Elizabeth Bishop. And Elizabeth Bishop is now recognized as a really terrific modern poet, but not as much during her lifetime. And in fact, I looked at the Norton anthology in here. She's in mine. She's not in that one. So, and the poem that we're going to look at today, if you had a Norton anthology that Elizabeth Bishop was in, you probably, this poem probably would not be in it. So,
And what's the difference in one of those two anthologies published?
The one that I have and the one in there? You know, I don't know. I didn't look at, I don't know mine at home when it was published versus that one. This one doesn't look exceptionally old or anything like that. I mean, it looks 90s or something like that. So, she really has, there's been a huge resurgence of her in popularity even in the last 10 or 20 years. So yes. Any other questions before we get started?
Does a poem have to rhyme?
You know what? No. And we're going to look at one right now that sure does not. And someone just went to make more copies. So if you don't have one, she'll come back and you can raise your hand.
I went with Aunt Consuelo to keep her dentist appointment and sat and waited for her in the dentist's waiting room. It was winter. It got dark early. The waiting room was full of grown-up people, arctics and overcoats, lamps and magazines. My aunt was inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited, I read the National Geographic. I could read and carefully studied the photographs. The inside of a volcano, black and full of ashes. Then it was spilling over in rivulets of fire. Osa and Martin Johnson, dressed in riding breeches, lace boots, and, how do you say that word? Pith helmets. A dead man slung on a pole. Long pig, the captain said. Babies with pointed heads, wound round and round with string. Black, naked women with necks wound round and round with wire, like the necks of light bulbs. Their breasts were horrifying. I read it right straight through. I was too shy to stop. And then I looked at the cover, the yellow margins, the date. Suddenly, from inside came a, oh, of pain. Aunt Consuelo's voice, not very loud or long. I wasn't at all surprised. Even then, I knew she was a foolish, timid woman. I might have been embarrassed, but wasn't. What took me completely by surprise was that it was me, my voice, and my mouth. Without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt. We were falling, our eyes glued to the cover of the National Geographic, February 1918. I said to myself, 3 days, and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I, you are an Elizabeth, you are one of them. Why should you be one too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher. At shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots, and different pairs of hands lying under the lamp. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt, or me, or anyone? What similarities, boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, held us all together or made us just one? How, I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely, how had I come to be here, like them, and overhear a cry of pain that could have got loud and worse but hadn't. The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another. Then I was back in it. The war was on, outside, in Worcester, Massachusetts, where were nights and slush and cold, and it was still the 5th of February, 1918.
Okay. So we're going to work through this poem a little bit at a time here, because there's a lot here, a lot that gets covered. Does somebody want to read the first, let's see, 11 lines again, up to the line, lamps and magazines, just to hear that first part in a different voice. Fabulous.
In Worcester, Massachusetts, I went with Aunt Consuelo to keep her dentist appointment and sat and waited for her in the dentist's waiting room. It was winter. It got dark early. The waiting room was full of grown-up people, arctics and overcoats. Lamps and magazines.
Okay, so what do we know about the speaker in these first lines? How is she revealing herself to us? What do we learn?
She's a child.
Mm-hmm.
She's a niece.
She's a niece, great.
Oh, well, I made an assumption there, didn't I? Or no.
Well, I mean, you know,
she has
an aunt.
She has an aunt.
Yeah, but I mean, she could have been a nephew. I mean.
Oh, right. And later we learn Elizabeth, though,
okay.
So you're good. You're good. I mean, where are we?
Massachusetts.
Worcester, Massachusetts, and more specifically?
In a dentist's office,
in the waiting room, right?
In the waiting room.
Talk to me a little bit about waiting rooms. What are waiting rooms like?
Depressing.
Depressing.
Elevators that don't go anywhere.
They don't go anywhere, yes, right? There's a feeling of being between things, right? Purgatory is a kind of waiting room, right? You don't know which way you're going yet. Yeah, say more. What?
Good fuel for disgust.
Good fuel for disgust?
Yes.
Yeah, say more.
Well, it's just that why isn't something happening?
Yes. Okay, so there's a sense of like pause, like it's a moment where nothing's happening in your life because you're just waiting.
I see two people behind the glass talking, drinking coffee, mm-hmm. and I put my name on that list a half an hour ago.
Right. So frustration.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh.
Waiting room. Oh. I'll be quick. Okay. Waiting room are full of anxiety.
Full of anxiety.
That's what
great.
I was gonna say.
Well, good. See, that's why we're both talking at the same
time. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so anxiety, nervousness.
Especially at the dentist's office.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Somebody may be in pain.
Someone may be in pain.
Mm-hmm. They're very limiting.
Limited. Yeah.
It's never the right thing to read or look at or entertain yourself with.
Yeah. Are they usually beautiful spaces?
No. Try not sometimes.
Sometimes they try. Yeah. But mostly they're sort of this contained waiting space that often isn't very... Well, not noticeable, unique, or, right? A lot of them are very much the same, too, right?
But
yeah.
There's something called liminal space.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of like the wardrobe in Narnia.
Yeah.
It means that it's a space that is like between two worlds.
Right.
And, I mean, somebody sort of said that before, but it's like there's that world of health and, you know, regularity, and then there's this other world where, you know, you don't know. You might walk in there and find out that you're dying.
Uh-huh. Same.
I think, though, when you're a kid, it's pretty different when you're seven than when you've been to a bunch of waiting rooms.
Yes. Okay, so when you're seven, what's your
foreignness is exciting, kind of, in a lot of ways. You know, if you haven't been around a lot of sterile things, it's not like
it can be exciting, or it could be
scary.
Boring, right? It could also just be really boring, right? Especially if there's not that much going on. So depending on sort of what's going on, could be either of those things. Okay, so she's very specific about where we are in the United States, this room that we're in. She's a niece. We know she's a child. What season are we in?
Winter.
Winter. Do you have a sense of what it's like outside?
Cold
and dark. She says it got dark early, so maybe it's not dark at that moment. We kind of assume that it is in that place, right? Of that, like, that 5 p.m. comes, right? And it's all of a sudden, boom, dark, and you're cold. And what's everybody else wearing?
Heavy clothes.
Yeah. And okay, here's my question. I already asked one person. Arctics. Are those boots? Does anybody know what Arctics are?
Mm-hmm.
Boots? Is that right? Okay.
Snow
boots. All right.
Big rubber boots.
Big rubber snow boots. Okay.
And they probably have buckles on them.
All right.
I hate to wear them to school.
I knew that Holden was the one place. Like, I looked it up in the Oxford English Dictionary and nothing. And I was like, Holden is the one place where I can walk in and somebody will definitely know what the word means. Okay. Anybody want to say anything else about those sort of introductory lines? In terms of tone or how you're feeling or...
It feels a little odd to me.
Okay.
She's with her aunt.
Mm-hmm.
She's in a waiting room, which is a place that nobody voluntarily goes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering why she's there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Why she's waiting.
Why is she hanging out with her aunt?
Yeah.
At the dentist.
Yeah.
On a winter night.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a weird thing for a seven-year-old to be doing.
Yeah.
Just for the sheer recreation of it.
Right.
And she's kind of alone because her aunt has gone in to the dentist already.
Right.
She's a little girl and she's sitting out there with strangers all by herself.
Yes, great. Okay, so she's isolated, she's surrounded by strangers, right, in this waiting space. Okay, so my aunt was inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited, I read the National Geographic. I could read and carefully studied the photographs. Okay, has everyone here had the experience of thumbing through a National Geographic at some point in your life?
Nice.
Yes, okay, so the pictures that we get here, right, we're gonna get a series of pictures. Does anybody wanna read through those pictures again? Thanks, Fred.
My aunt inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited, I read the National Geographic. I could read and carefully studied the photographs. Inside of a volcano, black and full of ashes.
Okay, everybody got that? That's clear to everyone, yes? Okay, the next picture.
Then it was spilling over in rivulets of fire. Osa and Martin Johnson, dressed in riding breeches, laced boots, and hip helmets.
Okay, do people know who Osa and Martin Johnson are?
No. No.
Okay. Big explorers and anthropologists of that time who would fly around on these airplanes and shoot some of like the first documentaries of, I don't know if does anybody know all of the places? I want to say like...
They flew around
Borneo.
In
New Guinea, Borneo.
In 1918.
Papua New Guinea.
Yeah. And some of the first, as they developed, some of their later... They got into films, and then later, like, films that actually had their narration and stuff along with it. But so they were very well known for that. Okay, next one.
A dead man slung on a pole. Long pig, the caption read, or said. Babies with pointed heads wound round and round with string. Black, naked women with necks wound round and round with wire. Like the necks of light bulbs. Their breasts were horrifying.
Okay, so what do you notice about these images, especially in relationship to what we've just read of the poem?
Well, she's a little girl reacting to pictures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great.
Everything's very not Massachusetts.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And what do you mean by not Massachusetts?
Everything's
far away.
Well, so
far away, yeah,
alien.
Right? And
it's a completely different culture.
Totally different cultures, right?
Alive.
Alive, yes. What else? Other words or... We're in a waiting room, right? That's very sterile, where she's alone, that feels isolated, it's cold and damp outside. How do these pictures feel, just in terms of their sensuality? What parts of your senses are you feeling sort of enacted?
I get the feeling this room is very stuffy.
There's
a bunch of people, there are a bunch of adults, yeah. They're wearing heavy boots.
Uh-huh.
They're cold, it's winter, it's awful. And now the stuffiness, she's kind of picking it up, now she's reading about volcanoes, and it's like she's dropping into this world that's the alien landscape.
Yes, so and the landscape is total, so we get a volcano, right, which is, I mean, temperature-wise here, right? We're on the other end of the spectrum, right? It was cold and damp where she is. Now we're talking about volcanoes. What else seems to be sort of in contrast? Yeah.
Well, I would think that the little girl would pick up that magazine, see that picture, and hardly believe her eyes.
Yeah, right. Sort of this sense of amazement.
Amazement,
fantasy. Absolutely.
There's a lot of movement.
Yeah.
You know, even riding breeches, laced boots, slung on a pole,
mm-hmm.
wound round and round, fire spilling over. There's just a lot of activity and action and movement. And
yes.
You can almost hear crackling fire and other stuff happening.
Yeah,
vivid.
We're jumping around in terms of our images and what's going on in them. There's a lot of kind of action and excitement. How about the way people are dressed?
The opposite of what she's looking at.
Right. The people in the waiting room have on these heavy overcoats, right? They're all dressed up for the cold weather. And what's she seeing in the magazine?
Naked
breasts, right? Yeah.
Naked women.
Startling.
Is a 7-year-old supposed to be reading National Geographic?
That's what it feels like. She's doing something she's not supposed to
do. Right. That's right.
Right,
if
and
her
said,
mother knew, if her mother knew what she was doing,
she wouldn't have it at home.
Oh.
Yeah.
She's at the dentist office.
So she's right.
Yeah,
and she
right.
says,
she's
I was too shy to stop.
Yeah.
Right? So we do have the sense that she's feeling embarrassed, but then to put it down seems like it would cause even more of a stir than just to keep it on your lap and pretend like everything's fine,
but
right?
The people were so different that she really wanted to look at that.
I remember
a little loving to look at National Geographic.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it feels other.
Maybe different people, right?
Yeah.
It's not picture books. It's not, this is a 6-7-year-old kid who's, this is a grown-up magazine. This is grown-up stuff. This is the world of adults.
Yes. Yes, great. Yeah.
I have this memory as a child of long shelves of National Geographic, and they smelled at a certain point. Old paper smell, and then that even connects to the pictures that there's in the volcano and the ashes and then the people sitting in the waiting room, your clothes. I don't know how I just smelled this whole poem.
Yeah. No, I totally had the same reaction too. That's the scent of those pages. It's very strong. So she's in this waiting room. It's this very contained, isolating place with people dressed up, and she's reading about this this entire other world that is very adult and very sensual, right? We have heat, we have nudity, we have this man strung on a pole, right? Things that are maybe not understandable. She's seeing images of people who go off and explore this other world, who are deeply invested in it, right? So there's this big contrast going on, right? Okay, does somebody want to read from, I read it straight through all the way to the break on the next page where it says February 1918, just to hear that section again?
I read it right straight through. I was too shy to stop. And then I looked at the cover, the yellow margins, the date. Suddenly from inside came an, pain, Aunt Consuelo's voice.
Okay, wait, I'm gonna stop you. I know, I said that I wasn't gonna interrupt you, and now I am. Okay, so she's read it straight through, she's too shy to stop, and then she looks at the cover, and can everybody see those yellow margins, right? Totally see that. The date. Then we get this line. Suddenly, from inside, came an O of pain. Where do you initially think, what does that inside refer to?
You think the dentist's office.
Yes.
No, inside the magazine.
Right, it could be either, right?
Right.
Right, she's just been looking at the magazine, so the immediate reference would be to inside the magazine, right? She's so in this other world, there's this O of pain that we hear comes from inside, but it turns out it's not inside, right? It's in the dentist's office.
Yeah, suddenly, you got the suddenly there, so that transitions.
Okay, so you felt that gave you a clue.
Yes.
Yeah, but she's, I want you to notice that right here, the first page, we have a very good sense of, like, she's in the waiting room, she's reading the magazine, the waiting room is the world that she's in, the magazine is this separate other world that's remote from her, all right? And then all of a sudden we get this line, suddenly from inside came an O of pain. And inside is this sort of hinging word, because the first, because of what's come right before, I looked at the cover, the yellow margins, the date, we're looking at the cover from inside. At some level, that's what that refers back to, right? But then we read two more sentences and realize, no, it's not referring to the magazine, it's referring to inside the dentist's office, right? Okay, so keep going, Karen.
Came an O of pain, Aunt Consuelo's voice, not very loud or long. I wasn't at all surprised. Even then, I knew she was a foolish, timid woman. I might have been embarrassed, but wasn't. What took me completely by surprise was that it was me, my voice, in my mouth. Without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt, and we were falling, our eyes glued to the cover of the National Geographic, February 1918.
Okay, so what has happened here?
All I can think is that there was a significance to the date, and she was reacting.
Didn't she close the magazine, look at the margin of it here? Do you think there's a time lapse?
I don't think there's a time lapse. I think she does. She has heard a sound of pain, I think, from the dentist's office. Right? That's been something that she's heard. But what happens to her in that moment? What does she say? It's not an entirely clear moment. There aren't, like, right or wrong answers
here. Well, it seems like the voice she hears, she thinks it's her aunt's voice, but it's her voice.
Yeah.
And she's read this kind of horrifying images in this magazine. She's closed it, seen the date, and realizes she's looking at something that's right now. This is a part of the world that's right now, and it's really opposite the world she understands, and it's almost like that horror for a seven-year-old that's coming out going,
right.
And she thinks it's her aunt's voice because they have similar voices, but it's not her aunt making any noise.
It's her.
It's her.
Okay.
And then she's like, it is my aunt's voice, but it's me.
Okay.
And there's this sense of suddenly she's in this moment, and she sees it as February 1918. It's like, this is now real to me. And she's falling, her eyes. She's falling into the magazine. She's like, oh my God, this is, it's like that whole room is now focused on the cover of the magazine,
okay.
On the date. But now she's no longer just a kid at 7 or 6 years old. Suddenly the world has become real.
Okay. Great. Sam, did you
have your head? Yeah, I think that Sarah touched on what I was going to say, that it's like she was taken away for a while, and then the world decorum returned for a second with her voice. Chastising her, whatever it was doing to her, but bringing her back to Massachusetts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's not entirely clear, I think, we hear this O of pain that she initially thinks, right, is from the dentist's office, but then what took me completely by surprise was that it was me, my voice in my mouth, right? So as Fred's saying, sort of question or tension between, is it her exclaiming over the magazine, or is it her aunt's voice, or is it sort of both collapsing, right? Either way, the sound that she hears, she initially thinks is her aunt's voice, but then realizes that it's hers, and at some level feels like their voices have become intertwined in some way. I think that it's not so important in this section to know exactly where the sound came from and who it came from. It's important to recognize her thought process as she goes through this, which is thinking it's her aunt's, realizing it's her own, and then my voice, my mouth, without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt, we are, right? Like, she has this moment where she's realizing the way that they're connected, that they're not separate, right? That she's attached to her aunt in these really interesting ways.
Anne,
you can
say? I wondered if she sees when she says, I was my foolish aunt, that she's going to become an adult. She's going
yes.
to become a grown woman.
Yes.
She's going to become someone like her aunt.
Yes. Right. So that up until then, right, just before, I knew she was a foolish, timid woman, right? There's this separation, but then all of a sudden we're in this moment of sort of collapse, right? That she, this realization that she's a part of that too. Okay.
I guess this is obvious, but it hasn't been spoken, that inside actually has three reference, not just two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Herself, yeah. Yes. Herself, the dentist's office, and inside the magazine, right? And this is, and that's, I'm glad you said that, because this is sort of the collapse that we're going to witness through the rest of the poem. These three worlds falling into each other, right? These three worlds that have felt very separate to her, right? Her own experience, her own self, the waiting room, or the dentist's room, which sort of signifies the adult world, right? Her aunt Consuela, like you're saying, which has seemed separate from her, and this other outside world, outside Massachusetts, that's been in the magazine. And now all of a sudden, there's this sound, and she can't tell where it's come from. It could have come from all three of those places.
There's this time element to it.
Yeah. It's, say more what you mean about that.
I don't know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a 1950 magazine. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming, well, this is another time.
She's right. Well, the speaker is looking back.
Yes.
Right? So this is in her past.
But
you're
yes,
wondering.
She's looking back. But I mean, it's sort of a time travel. I don't know. I don't know whether that is it.
Here's what confused me was I thought, because we're accustomed to National Geographic being old.
Right.
So my first assumption was she was looking at an old
National Geographic
rather than a current issue of the magazine.
I thought it was old because
that's
yellow
what I experienced.
Margins.
Yellow. Well, it has yellow margins, though, even when it's not.
Oh, it's yellow. So
yeah.
The
old-fashioned National Geographic did have a
yellow margin.
Well, it is yellow.
And then
yellow.
She was
yeah.
7 years old, and she was born in 1911.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It would
yeah.
make it a current.
Well, I wondered whether it was current, but then I kind of got the sense that it was
But
not.
Sarah, you're totally right, because the next line, right, she's experiencing this feeling of sort of falling and this sort of collapse. We were falling, our eyes glued to the cover of National Geographic. But then the first thing she does, right, to try to, in an intellectual way, sort of figure out what's going on, I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. So the first thing that she sort of does is try to get a grip on time as a way of kind of righting herself in terms of what's going on. So you're right, I think, that time does play. I know what you were saying in terms of time. But I think you're right that time does play an important element in terms of what's going on.
I think that, yes, the two lines at the bottom of the page, and then I looked at the cover, the yellow margins, the date. It almost sounds as if she's, here is the reminiscence, and then suddenly she, in her own memory, is drawn into it too, when she looks at the cover. And it seems like the first element of the time travel takes place there with those two lines to me too, that I understood that she was probably 7 years old at that time from her lifespan and everything. But I still got that feeling about those lines. And
so I'm lost. Are we, yeah. So we're still thinking this is in the future and she's looking back?
Okay, so because yeah, I think let's be clear about this. Well, first of all, what I want to acknowledge is that we're meant to feel discombobulated at this point in the poem. So what you're feeling in terms of, like, is this time travel? What is going on? That's how you're supposed to be feeling, I would argue, okay? So, like, that's not wrong to be feeling that way. This is a very confusing, weird moment in the poem. But the poem is dealing with a speaker, right? Like, the person telling us this story is older. We don't know how old the speaker of the poem is, right? She could be 60, she could be 50, she could be 40. We don't know for sure, okay? Mm-hmm. But she's looking back on a specific incident that happened when she was almost 7 years old. And so the whole time, so through this entire poem, we're talking about a girl who is that age. So that stays the same throughout. We're not jumping around within what's happening within the poem.
And she doesn't change tense throughout.
Right,
She's consistent vis-a-vis tense.
Right, right. And we know that for sure because she says February 1918, and in the last line, it was still the 5th of February 1918. Mm-hmm. So we know that the National Geographic matches up with the actual date. Does that make sense? You had your hand up.
I might have forgotten. Well, I was just kind of thinking, I always ask myself, like, what was the point of putting this in past or present tense?
Yeah.
Because it would have been pretty easy considering it's describing this one, 3 minutes of her life to put it in present tense. But then I also wondered how much later it was in the actual event. It could have been her 7th birthday or later. But for me, I guess when she says, I was my foolish aunt, it's kind of a line pretty heavy with comprehension for a little girl.
Yes.
And to really understand the significance, so I feel like it's been a lot later in life, kind of like looking back on this kind of everyday moment, or maybe not everyday, but.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's a great observation.
You have to be 30 or 35 to figure that out.
Yeah.
I'll start.
Well, that's kind of a shot in the dark. You know, Dana, worked at that time, a period of time, perhaps in the 20s, and there was slow drill and drilling teeth with a terrible pain. Do you think there possibly she was in a dentist chair and they gave her a little ether or anesthetic or something like that and she was dreaming?
I mean,
it's just a possibility.
Yeah, well, I think that you're totally right in the sense that the way that we feel at this moment in the poem feels like we are under some, like that we've been put under. And I think it's great that it is that sort of sense that when you're in the dentist's office and getting put, yeah, it is that. I don't think that the speaker at this moment in time, because she's in the waiting room, I don't think we're meant to believe that she herself is under anesthetic. But I think that's a great connection to me, for sure. Yeah.
What I would add, it makes me, I remember, I had a lot of dental work done as a child because I had bad teeth and there was no Novocaine. You have to sit there, and the pain of that drill going into your teeth was nothing. There weren't anesthetics, I remember. And if this goes way back to then, she would be hearing inside and realizing the kind of pain that her
mouth
was maybe going through.
I'm glad that you said that because it made me wonder why 1918, besides the war, this was written in the 70s, there's still like National Geographic of shocking foreign pictures at every year, and there's still pictures of war and pictures of everything. So it's interesting, like I feel like the atmosphere of the dentist's office would be significantly different and intentional, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that affects anything in the poem, but it's the most shocking thing is that there's a February 1918 Geographic, and it's still February 1918, because you don't ever have new magazines.
It's true. That's true. That's a great point.
I work at a dentist's office, and we get new National Geographics
in there. Oh,
yeah.
Good. See, that's her dentist's office. That's what we
good for
learn.
You.
Okay. So she says to herself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue, black space, right? Because when we're feeling discombobulated, right, we want to grip onto something. You want to say something to yourself in your mind, right? This is what she's saying to herself. But that's contrast with, but I felt, here's what she felt. You are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Okay? Them becomes a really loaded term here, right? Who could them be? The what?
The people in the pictures.
One of the people in the pictures? Yep. Who else?
I immediately thought adult woman.
Adult woman. So one of the, she's been looking around in the waiting room, right? At all the adults, all the grown-ups. So it might be being becoming a grown-up.
I was thinking about Aunt Consuela. She's becoming
right.
Women.
Okay.
Those women.
One of those women that make
for goodness
yelping
sakes,
sounds.
At six, what's the chance that she's actually called Elizabeth all the time?
Yeah.
But she's saying, you're not Elizabeth.
Right.
And those old ladies.
Right. Anybody else?
At first, what I thought she was making like a list of stuff that made her an individual, but like you said, she's contrasting, so she's kind of making a list of things that are kind of getting bigger and farther away from her,
yes,
from herself. She's saying you're an I, and then a bigger group you are an Elizabeth, and then an even bigger
yes
group you are just somebody.
Great. So she's having this revelation of who the self is in the world, right? She started poem, it was very clear. She was a girl in the waiting room. The others were grown-ups. The magazine was separate from her. And now she's had this moment. I'm an Elizabeth. I'm one of them. Why should you be one too? And again, this is a line that's a little bit foggy, right? Because the one can be read, why should you be one of them too? Or why should you be one as in an individual and a them? Does that make sense?
So it's also changed frame of reference here.
Yeah, go ahead, yeah, say more.
Well, she's using the second person all of a sudden in her
dialogue. Great. Great.
And that, and this poem doesn't change frame of reference too much as
right
it proceeds.
This is what, we're really inside what she's feeling in that moment with the use.
Yeah.
So I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was, right? Now she's gonna actually take a look around and see what it is she is by seeing the them again. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher at shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen. Right, so she's looked at, oh my goodness. Okay, all right. We're gonna breeze through a little bit here. All right, why should I be my aunt or me or anyone? Right? Why should I be? It's that question of, right, in the universe, why is it that you are the person you are and not someone else? Right? Why am I not Sam or Dan or, right? Like, why is it that I'm Kata? What similarities, boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, held us all together or made us all just one? And that's an interesting phrase too, all just one.
But she also said, why should you be one too?
Yeah, right?
So
this
oneness,
oneness
yeah,
is a really interesting. And because we're running out of time, I'm gonna just keep moving. How, I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely, how had I come to be here, like them, and overhear a cry of pain that could have got loud and worse, but hadn't. And what's that a reference to?
What am I doing here?
Yeah, what?
Sounds like a birth to me of sorts.
Yeah.
You know, the birth cry of someplace.
Yeah, yeah, that's great, that's really interesting, yeah. I mean, what's going on right now, too, in the world?
The war,
right? So all of a sudden, there's this question of, why am I me and here in this place and not, why am I not born there? Why am I not elsewhere? Why am I, Elizabeth, here and not someone else there, right? Because, and Aunt Consuelo's cry of pain, it stopped, right? So it's also a differentiation between those whose cries of pain are not necessarily stopping, right? That she's in a place where cries of pain can be stopped. Did you guys buy that? I'm moving kind of quickly, so when we get to the end, everybody can throw out all the other things they're noticing here, okay? The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another, right? We have the sense of drowning and darkness and trauma, this experience. Then I was back in it, and it we could discuss. It's the waiting room, but it's probably a lot of other things too. The war was on outside in Worcester, Massachusetts, where night and slush and cold, and it was still the 5th of February, 1980. Right? So in this, she's had this moment, which probably lasted all of 3 minutes, right? It really was just 10 minutes, paging through this magazine, hearing this cry, having these thoughts. We're still at the same place and time, but her entire sense of the world and who she is in it and her relationship to the other, right, has totally undergone a shift. Yeah. What we didn't get to discuss yet, and we won't have time to, is the way, and what I want to do is I'll throw out a couple more things, and then we'll open it up for any kind of final comments that people want to have, say about anything, because we flew through this ending really fast. So any other interpretations you want to offer, questions? What we didn't get to talk about is form. Her form is free verse and lots of short lines. We didn't get to talk about the way that her form might be interacting with the content of this. But I also want to ask you whether you think that this is a great poem based on our criteria. And also back to this question of, could this poem, and this is it's an honest question, could this poem be summarized? Could it be told better in an essay that explains this moment? Because certainly there are essays that deal with this sort of thing, right? Personal essays that want to explore a life-changing moment in early childhood. Could it be done just as well through that? Or at some level, is poetry necessary to us really understanding this moment for her? Thoughts on any of those things? Yeah.
I don't know if this is related, but in hearing this read through, if I was, say I turned public radio on and I heard this being read,
yeah,
how would I know it's a poem and not a short story?
Okay, anybody want to respond to that?
A short story.
Yeah, anybody want to respond?
We spoke a little bit about this yesterday, the notion that I agree with you that, but I had the same experience with some of the other poetry that we talked about this week, that hearing it is not the same as reading it. And that's where the intentionality of form and structure sort of comes into play. That just hearing this wouldn't be as meaningful as being able to look at the line breaks and look at the construction. So I think that might be part of what makes this greater than, if not great, is that the line breaks and the structure that's chosen will give it more meaning and intentionality than if it was just paragraph prose that you heard and read on NPR. You might be able to get from it by digging around in the line breaks and how she phrased things and even how she produced stanzas and paragraphs as opposed to just a long thing.
It's that kind of thing that prompts the variation in the way the speaker or the reader hears it. Yeah, you could rush through it and it would sound like a poorly constructed essay. But with various intonations and pauses and expressions, it becomes poetic rather than prose.
I guess I feel like the thing that's happened to her part of the rest of humanity. In a kind of, yeah, transcendent way. And then, right here at the end, which is, you know, so momentous, and then right here at the end, the part about the black wave, one and then another, to me, there's a moment of kind of pure child innocence there, because I think she's falling asleep. And then she awakens, and there is her new reality.
See, and I had the same thought. It's a hot, stuffy waiting room. Winter, she's warm, she's kind of bored. And so I'm not convinced that an essential change has taken place, that she might have been sort of in this dozy, half-awake, imaginary space. Then it was back in it, reality.
Yeah.
The door was on outside. It was Rooster Mask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that maybe she's snapping back and doesn't have as fundamental a shift as we're attributing.
Huh.
That
yeah,
she had this perceptual moment that came and went. And I've got a 6, almost 7-year-old who probably has an epiphany a day.
yeah. But her adult self is the speaker who wrote this.
Right.
Still believe, you know, I mean, still remembers it as that, but you're right, whether that child then goes back to it or not.
Yeah, there's a sense of maybe looking at another world, but then coming back into the real world, and maybe 50 years from now, she sees it differently
yeah.
than she
I
still
think that's an experience that I have, is, you know, and it can just be like being tired and comfy,
yeah.
you know, letting your brain sort of unravel a little bit, but I have those experiences, and I can't remember why it seems significant. So I guess that's kind of why something like this happens. You're writing something down that happened to you, you know, 50 years ago, trying to say, like, I still don't get this. You know, trying to explain it to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
These seem like such big thoughts for a 7-year-old to have.
Yeah.
And I'm almost thinking, you know, here she is in the 70s, and that's at the
mm-hmm.
time of
yeah.
war.
Yeah.
And is she using this memory that she had as a 7-year-old as a vehicle?
Yep.
Understand
yes.
time.
Yes, and that is a great, the time in which this poem was written and how is it talking to the time in which the little girl experienced this, right? Yeah, how much of it is the speaker putting on to the child? I think that's a great question for this poem. I do think that as like Alan was talking about this morning, well, a little bit about, you know, why do we read the book of Esther when it doesn't have anything to do overtly, right, with Jesus and Christianity? I talked about, you know, that literature is Christian insofar as it is teaching us truths. And I would like to suggest that one way to read this poem is that this is the moment where she learns empathy. Empathy. That it's the moment where she learns that she is not just an I, that she is connected to those in the waiting room, she is connected to those in the National Geographic, she is connected to those in the war who are on the other side of the world and suffering. And that's just one way to read why she's gone back and written this poem, that it was the moment in her life where that turned. And if this was a writing class, I would then turn around and ask all of you if you can think of a moment in your life when you learned empathy. What would that moment be? Was there one? So I'm gonna leave you with that. And thank you for doing such a terrific job with this poem. Tomorrow, we're going to discuss, Saturday we're going to discuss a very contemporary poem about motherhood, of which there are not many poems written about that